This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Universal 1440's Unbroken, Path to Redemption, based on the best-selling book telling the rest of the true story of Olympian and World War II hero Louis Zamperini. Louis finds love, but still must battle to learn how to forgive his captors and find peace in God. Unbroken, Path to Redemption, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13, in theaters September 14th. More information is available at unbrokenfilm.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Hey, everybody. Great to have you with us again. We hear all the time about the religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, those people, especially millennials, who might have grown up in the Christian faith but end up leaving their churches when they get older. Now, according to recent Pew Research Center data, part of the reason is because they question Christianity in general or because they don't like their church's stances on social or political issues. At least that's what we're led to believe. But do these statistics really tell the whole story? We're going to talk now with Christian apologist, author, and cold case detective J. Warner Wallace, who also serves as senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. His latest book, Forensic Faith for Kids, and he addressed this important question of why young Christians are leaving the church in a new piece over at FoxNews.com. Jim, so good to have you here. How are you?
Really good to be with you, as always. You know how I feel about coming on your show, so I'm glad to get the call.
I'm really glad to have you here because you take this data and you give a new twist on it. Can you tell us a little bit about this recent report that Pew put out and what they learned about religious nuns?
Well, they did a survey a couple of years back where they were just looking at the temperature of Christianity in America, and it was a really interesting survey that they have then kind of parsed out and restudied and looked at the particulars of, and then have been posting articles over the last couple of years in which they've looked at specific data from that study. And that study shows that we've got young people leaving the church in pretty dramatic numbers, and the church size, if you go back and look at Pew polls going over the last 15 years, you'll see that those who would claim to be Christian are shrinking by about 1% a year. And the number of people who are now in that religiously unaffiliated, so when they ask which religion do you affiliate with, they would say none. This is why we call them the nuns. That has been growing by about 1% a year. And the first surveys I started reading on this, Janet, were back in the late 90s, early 2000s. I was a youth pastor, and I saw my own young people leaving in their college years. And we've had now, I think, three generations of polls since about 1999 that have given us data. And the first generation of polls kind of said, well, how many people are leaving? Okay, it's not a good number. It's pretty large. The second generation of polls was, in your own words, tell us why you're leaving. And the third generation of polls was, well, when did you really leave? About when did you begin to check out? So this latest rethinking or just an examination of the older Pew poll, they just released it on August 8th, and they're talking about, well, you know, why American nuns don't identify with a religion. And if you just look at the data, the way it's been presented, you might think it's because they just really question a lot of religious teachings of the church, or they don't like the positions they take on social or political issues. I think there's some truth to that, don't get me wrong. Or they just don't like religious organizations. But you'll see the largest number is, I just don't believe in God. Hmm. Interestingly, in the survey, it talks about, it kind of lists the reasons why people are unaffiliated. But the third or fourth reason they list is actually the largest number by a long shot. And they don't talk about it as though it is the largest number. So it's not just that young people may have problems with the teaching of the church. But look, if you don't believe God exists at all, well, then of course you don't believe in the teaching of the church.
Right.
So that's really the tail that wags the dog. And so I'm looking at the data that says, okay, why don't you believe in God? That to me is the most important issue.
Well, it is. Now, this 2018 report that's just come out in the last couple of weeks,
yes,
these are mainly under 35 and mainly ex-Christians, right? Those who grew up in a,
yes,
Christian church, either Protestant or Catholic.
Yeah, so that's where we get into some language, right? So theologically, is there such a thing as an ex-Christian? Well, the point is, what we're saying here, these are people who grew up and who at one point in their youth identified as being a part of Christianity. They would have said, if you asked them, they would have said, oh yeah, I'm a Christian. Now, what does that really mean? Well, that doesn't really matter to me. What I'm looking at is what is happening in the life of young people that caused them to step out of the church. And we know that only about a third, most studies will still tell us this, only about a third are ever going to return. So I'm trying to figure out, okay, so what do we do about it? We're not going to change the teaching of Scripture, because you just can't do that. Scripture is not malleable that way. We're fixed on that. But it turns out that's not the real problem anyway. The real problem is that they will tell you when they're surveyed in their own words, and look, Pew's done that. There's actually an older survey that Pew did that I think is more telling. That's why I talk about it in the Fox article. And that's where they just simply ask, without giving you multiple choice, because this survey we're talking about most recently in 2018, they're really just looking at, you know, they gave multiple choice answers. And a lot of these young people just picked one, and they'll even tell you later on, really, none of those were the ones I would have said on my own. Okay, what would you have said on your own? Well, that's an early Pew poll, and that tells us in their own words why they are no longer Christians. And that's the thing that I think is the most telling and where we should be focused.
Absolutely. Well, I know the easy answer would be to just say, if they're not Christians, they were never Christians. It's not that they were Christians and walked away, that sort of thing. But really what you're getting at is the reason that somebody might be in the church for any length of time and then walk away from it.
That's right.
And you say the real reason was they no longer believed Christianity was true, which is interesting, because what are they basing that on? It's difficult to know all the details, but that is a big reason, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Let's think about this. It used to be that 85% of Christians would become a Christian by the age of 18. When I was younger, when I first became a Christian myself 20 years ago, and I was 35, I was in that small 15% of people who ever become a Christian after the age of 18. Well, the most recent polling we have is like about 2015, 2016, and it shows that if you aren't a Christian by the age of 13, you have an 85% are before the age of 13, and only 15% after 13. Well, what's happening is the age of skepticism is dropping.
Right.
And the reason why it's dropping is that first place where you might have met skepticism 25 years ago might have been in university. The first place you meet skepticism today is at the end of your arm. It's in your phone. And so many young people have access to the internet that that's where they're first meeting skepticism. And if you listen to their responses, when they are allowed to tell you why are you out, their responses tell us this. They'll say things like, I've learned about evolution, I went away to college, or I learned about it online. Religion, they'll say, of course, the classic line is the opiate of the people. That rational thought makes religion go out the window. These are their words. The lack of any sort of scientific or specific evidence of a creator was a problem. Or they just realized somewhere along the line they didn't really believe it. Or they'll say something like, I'm doing a lot more learning, studying, and kind of making decisions myself rather than listening to someone else tell me. Well, if you look at those answers, and that really is very similar. I've collected, I think, 4 surveys now in which students have been able to give their own answers. They're very similar. The vast majority come down to intellectual, rational skepticism.
Wow.
Some categories are about, I've seen hypocrisy in the church, but to be honest, that's a very distant second to the largest group of, when you ask them and they get to pick their own answers, that's what they're telling us. So that's where we need to be doing our work.
Well, that's interesting when you talk about intellectual skepticism. Is it a convenient excuse? Because that's obviously at odds with the evidential history that supports the Christian faith. So how do we make sense of that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I absolutely agree with you that it's going to be voiced as intellectual skepticism. That sounds a lot better than emotional or volitional skepticism,
yes,
which is really where the lion's share, I think, of skepticism lies. Okay, I just believe that. I think all the numbers will support that. But you're not going to offer to somebody who's, if you want to sound like I've got good reason to reject this, when in fact it might be your own desire and will that is driving you to reject it. So I always look at it and say, I don't believe that being able to answer all of these objections for young people is going to solve the problem necessarily, but I do believe it's going to remove the lame excuses that people give when something else is really at the core. So my sense of it is, look, I'm not going to allow you to sit and give me these kinds of excuses if I know we've got good answers. But to be honest, a lot of leaders right now in youth groups across America don't offer good answers
right,
to these.
Right.
And so they can rest on these kinds of claims when, in fact, they aren't well-supported evidentially. There is a rich evidential history to Christianity. It has always been so. And we cannot allow people to use these kinds of excuses. So we just want to remove the barriers that prevent people from hearing the gospel. That's what happened for me. I was somebody who held all of these objections. I was 35 years old, and you could never get to the gospel message with me because I would stop you with one of these. And everyone I approached, everyone who was a Christian who tried to approach me with the gospel, I was able to stop them in their tracks with one of these kinds of questions. Then in the conversation, we could never get past this. They never had good answers for these things. So what I'm suggesting is we want to get to the gospel proclamation. You're going to have to remove some barriers.
Absolutely. Jay Warner Wallace with us. We're going to come back talking about skepticism and young Christians leaving the church. Stay with us. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you'll access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 per month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. Regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. That number again, 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org.
From Universal 1440 comes Unbroken, Path to Redemption. Based on the best-selling book, telling the rest of the true story of Olympian and World War II hero Louis Zamperini.
Tonight, there's a drowning man just looking for some type of hope for the future. But there's a lifeline. Just reach out.
Unbroken, Path to Redemption. Rated PG-13. May be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters September 14th. More information is available at unbrokenfilm.com.
If you're a medical professional, here's a way to move from success to even greater significance. Mercy Ships has an urgent need for pediatric registered nurses. You'll be joining dozens of volunteer medical professionals who've been blessed by the opportunity.
I think all nurses should do something like this. To serve the unserved is one of the most beautiful experiences.
Get more information by visiting mercyships.org/nurses. Mercy Ships, bringing hope and healing to the world's forgotten poor.
Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Great to have you here, and always great to have with us Christian apologist Jay Warner Wallace. His new book is called Forensic Faith for Kids. We're talking about his Fox News piece, Young Christians Are Leaving the Church, Here's Why. Looking a little bit more deeply into the religious nuns problem, N-O-N-E-S. I always have to spell that, you know, Jim, so
know,
people don't misunderstand and think about, you know, nuns in the convent or something like that.
Yeah.
One of the things that you were mentioning is the fact that intellectual skepticism seems to play a part just in the professions of some of these young Christians who are leaving the church. But you made a good point that in reality, there probably is more emotional and volitional skepticism than anything else. And I think this comes out sometimes. One of my favorite things is when someone will say, well, the Bible has so many contradictions, and my response is always, name one, and they never can.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So,
hearing these 280 word talking points, you know, 280 character talking points you can tweet, and those are very pithy. There's memes out there. There's an entire, if you were to Google, for example, Christianity right now, you will find that the first 5-6 pages will always have more in terms of anti-Christian literature than Christian literature.
Wow.
If you said evidence for the resurrection or whatever, you will see that really there's much more out there to choose from that are, again, look, the fact of it is we're all humans and we all have our fallen desires that we would like to pursue. And in order to do that and feel comfortable about it, we would love to believe that there is no moral standard that we really have to oblige ourselves to, and that as long as you're not hurting anybody, I can do whatever I want. And so, of course, if that's our real desire, and all of us as humans, I think, would like that to be our desire, right? We want autonomy. And we're in a culture right now that elevates autonomy. Well, what is Christianity? It's the worldview of submission and restraint. because there's something higher that is actually, we can absolutely be enslaved to our autonomy, enslaved to our desires. So God offers us something better, but it is about something that I think the culture is aligned against, because we have elevated autonomy to the point where we're going to have to help our kids to delay gratification, to realize that you aren't the God of everything, and that everything you think is not necessarily true, and everything you desire to do is not necessarily good. These are the kinds of things that I think are going to be harder and harder to promote as the culture becomes and elevates autonomy.
Right, and along with that, teach them not everything you read on a new atheist website is to be believed either. Have some skepticism when it comes to what you're reading on the internet.
Yeah, have some skepticism about skepticism. So I always say this, and we're going to be at Ohio State tomorrow night, and I know that these questions are going to come up, and because they always do in a college setting. And this idea is that I think that there is more than enough evidence to infer that God exists and that Christianity is true. But there's also enough wiggle room for somebody, if they have a mind to deny both of those things. And I actually think that that is what I think most of us. This happens in every criminal trial. Every criminal trial has enough evidence to infer the verdict, but then we have enough wiggle room that we might get hung.
Yes.
And that's why I think God would want it to be. He's a gentleman. He's not going to force himself. If you want to have a true free choice to choose Jesus as Savior, well, then there has to be this condition that there's more than enough evidence to infer this is true, yet enough wiggle room for you to make a free choice if you choose to deny it. And this is, I think, where we are in criminal trials. It's where we are with God. And so when young people see that, gosh, you know, there's objections. By the way, is the first place they're seeing the objections when they get into a situation where they are away from their family? I want them to see all the objections while they're with me. This is why, you know, this idea of writing kids' books was so popular. It's such an important idea for Susie and I. We just knew that if the age of skepticism is 13, well, then we want young people between 8 and 12 to encounter all the objections and all the reasons why those objections don't work, to encounter the evidence for God's existence, the evidence for Christianity. And we needed to figure out a way to do that we thought would be also entertaining and engaging. And that's why our kids' books are really not just about, well, here's why it's true. They're really fictional books in which the characters are trying to solve a mystery and learning how to be a detective in an academy for detectives, and they are trying to figure out how to solve the mystery. Now, along the way, we hope to teach them how to think rationally and respond to some of these objections.
Yeah, it's great, and you really do a good job in Forensic Faith for Kids unpacking that in a way that younger kids can understand. And it is important, as you mentioned before, Jim, because the age of skepticism keeps going down. Now, the question becomes, are we neglecting apologetics in the church to a degree that in some way we have to hold ourselves responsible for not preparing these kids to at least have enough evidence for the Christian faith that if they do reject it, at least they knew what they were rejecting?
Yeah, that's such a good point. Sean McDowell and I are right now getting ready to write another book. It's really about how to teach Gen Z Christian worldview. And one of the things I always say is that, look, when you're raising kids, you make sacrifices for your actual biological children. So for all those years I raised my kids, I've got four, they're all out of the house now. But when I raised my kids, I knew that I wasn't going to go to the restaurant that I wanted to go to. I was going to go to the one that was good for my kids. I wasn't going to go to the movie I wanted to go to or the vacation I wanted to take. We made these sacrifices in that season of raising kids. So here we are as a church with the big C, and we've got to make a decision. We're in a season, we're always going to be in this season, of raising kids. Are we willing to do what it takes, even though it may not be your form of music or the topic that you think you'd like to have at this point in your life? But look, you made that sacrifice for your own kids, and we have to make that decision now. These are our kids. They're all of our kids, and we have to make a decision. And I don't want them. Look, if they leave in college or in those years because they want to chase their passions and do silly things that all of us, you know, want to do when we're in those years, fine, that's on them. If they're leaving because they don't think it was true, that's on us. And I think that's why it's a time for us as a church, as a family, to say we got young ones in this family. And that means that, you know, when you have young ones who are still in your family, those are the seasons which you lay in and you deny yourself to do what's right for them. And I think we probably are at that place right now.
Well, I agree. What would you say would be some of your tips for pastors who are listening right now or Sunday school teachers, on how, for example, as a Sunday school teacher or a Bible study leader, you would answer the question for, say, a youth group, here's how we know God exists. As you mentioned before, we have evidence, obviously, that God exists and that Jesus rose from the dead and all the other main doctrines of the Christian faith. Yes, there's some wiggle room if you really don't want to believe. But how would you make that case in a brief summary and maybe expand on it later? But how would you begin to really prove that to a young mind, somebody who really needs that?
Well, for God's existence, we tried to do it in an adult book called God's Crime Scene, where we looked at the attributes of the universe and said, what is the best explanation for these attributes? And so we did the same thing in the kids' version, where we said, look, you know, if you're trying to figure out, can I get all the stuff that's in the universe with just the stuff of the universe, space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry? I see things in the universe that you could never get with just space, time, physics, and chemistry. You know, you'd have to have something outside of naturalism to be able to explain the stuff that we see inside of naturalism. Yes. This is how we investigate crimes, by the way. We separate death scenes from murder scenes by simply asking the question, can I explain everything in the room by staying in the room? Now, that's what we're doing in that book, right? I think there's like eight things. How did the universe get here? Why does it appear to be fine-tuned for the existence of life like ours? How does life emerge from non-life? And then why does it appear to be designed? And how are we able to think about this with our conscious immaterial mind if all you have is the material universe? And how do we have freedom, the kind of freedom we would not have if we were simply physical beings that were just reacting to prior physical events? And how do we know that the moral truths that we believe exist and apply to all of us, how do we ground those properly? And finally, how do we determine something is evil unless we have a standard for good, which is objective and holy, that we can compare and say, yes, compared to that standard, this is evil? I think there are lots of things in the universe you can't explain unless you step out of the universe for something extra natural, a personal first cause that's all powerful and is the source of those eight things. It's how we ground those eight things. And I think for pastors, I would simply say, forget about all that for a minute. Just do this. We do a lot in church about telling young people what is true. Just make sure you never give a what unless you also give a why.
Oh, that's
if
good.
That's all you did, you'd be fine. So if you're going to make a case that you're going to say that God is triune in nature, well, make a case for why that is philosophically sound, why that's theologically sound, why that's not a logical contradiction, because those are the things people are going to say on the outside. If whatever you give, just make sure you always give a why. And if you just do that, you'll see a huge change in both your teaching and how young people respond, because what they're really looking for is the why.
It's true.
They're looking for whys.
Yeah, it's true.
And we got to start giving them the whys. And I think that, to me, they all spend, because you always see, you know, why would God do that? You know, how could this be true? They're really looking for explanations for all the standard whats. Okay, if God's the creator of everything in the universe, who created God?
Yes.
They want those kinds of things answered. You know, how can an all-powerful, all-loving God allow anything bad to happen to little children who don't even know that God exists yet?
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are the kinds of things we have to be able to answer for young people. So these are the whys. And that's why I think it's so important for us to kind of, it doesn't mean you have to change your approach. Just make sure that every proclamation of truth is it accompanied by an explanation.
Well, and what I love about your approach and always have is the fact that you will engage the mind. When you're talking about a generation that has all sorts of intellectual skepticism, clearly what that really is telling us is they want their minds to be challenged. And if you throw them some intellectual meat to chew on, to think through, that can change someone's life. I mean, look at your own life. Obviously, we have lots of circumstances in which an atheist or somebody who is a skeptic got a little bit of a challenge to think something through and maybe hit a barrier and then began to dig. And the next thing you know, that guy became a Christian.
Yeah, you know, there is some research that we are sadly raising a generation that may have been somewhat rewired in how they think because of the digital environment in which they live, right? That smartphone, there's some research that suggests that it actually reduces people's cognitive capacity. And their ability to memorize. I mean, we've kind of relinquished a lot of our old ability to memorize and put things together to why should I memorize that when I can find it on my phone in 5 seconds? I mean, do I really need to know that? I mean, I can almost relinquish all of my thought process to the data that's available to me online. That's the kind of thing we have to overcome. I think that young people want us to help them overcome that.
I agree. Well, coldcasechristianity.com, Forensic Faith for Kids, the new book from J. Warner Wallace. Jim, always a delight to have you here. Thank you so much.
So glad to be with you. I hope we do it again.
You got it. Absolutely. God bless you. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Universal 1440's Unbroken, Path to Redemption, based on the best-selling book telling the rest of the true story of Olympian and World War II hero Louis Zamperini. Louis finds love, but still must battle to learn how to forgive his captors and find peace in God. Unbroken, Path to Redemption, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13, in theaters September 14th. More information is available at unbrokenfilm.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. I don't know about you. I have been concentrating a lot in my Bible reading on some of these passages about the last days. And it isn't just because certain events have reminded us of the Olivet Discourse or some of the things that we read about in the book of Revelation, but just because I'm looking at the culture all around me and thinking to myself, Lord, where are you taking us all? What is going on? There are so many things going on that are very concerning, but in a new way. We've always had bad guys. We've always had wars. We've always had turmoil of different types. We've had periods of history that were way worse than our own. And I recognize that. Every generation maybe thinks to some extent, this is as bad as it's ever been. And I don't want to go there because we live in the United States and we are greatly blessed and we've had all sorts of wonderful things that God has given to us. And I'm extremely grateful. We're not in prisons. We're not bleeding for our faith or anything like that. But I was looking at 2 Timothy chapter 3, and you'll recall the beginning of that chapter begins this way. But realize this, that in the last days, difficult times will come. Difficult times, for men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious, gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, holding to a form of godliness, although they have denied its power. Avoid such men as these. And I focus in on a couple of different words in that list. It's a long list, obviously. But how is it that men will be in the last days? Two of those words really stuck out for me: irreconcilable and haters of good. And maybe even the word brutal. All of them are equally important. This is the word of God. But those three especially jumped out to me: irreconcilable. In other words, I don't want to see your point of view. I don't want to have any sort of interaction with you where you have an opinion and I have an opinion and we can come together and we can work through our problems and stand together as friends. No, there will be none of that. We're not going to reconcile. And haters of good, men who simply will look at what is out there, whether it is completely evil or just a little bit evil, and say, that's fine with me. Not just promoting it necessarily, but going along with others who do promote it. And the word of God speaks to those people too. Why do I bring this up? Well, because we have had just this week a number of different incidents where you have people on the left who are engaging in acts of violence. You might have heard about this incident in California involving this Republican congressional candidate who had a knife pulled at him. When he was at this election booth at a town festival, there was a leftist who came along screaming about Donald Trump and tried to stab him with a switchblade. Now, this is just a microcosm of what we've seen over the last couple of years. I want to go to Fox 5 New York, and you can listen to this. This is a little bit of the report. Cut one.
Republican congressional candidate Rudy Peters says he was at his booth at the Castro Valley Fall Festival Sunday with another GOP candidate greeting voters when they heard yelling from this man, 35-year-old Farzad Fazeli of Castro Valley.
We hear somebody screaming, you know, the cuss word, Donald Trump. We look up and he's got his hand over his head with his middle finger up.
Peters says they ignored him, but then the man stops.
Well, then he stops and we hear him say, well, I'll show you. So he turns and he rushes my table.
Peter showed us a blue ceramic mug that he says Fazeli picked up and threw at him.
By that time, I've come around the table and he's coming at me, so I grab him, threw him on the ground. His shirt got ripped, his beer mug busted. I got off of him, and that's when he jumped up and pulled the knife out and said he's going to kill me.
Peter said Fazeli couldn't open his knife. Peters picked up a sign as a shield, but then someone stepped in and broke up the incident. Peter said he alerted Alameda County Sheriff's deputies.
We had deputies out in the areas during the festival, and so they heard about it, that this incident had happened, and were able to track down the suspect and take him into custody.
Now, that's horrible enough on its face. You're just there. You're trying to interact with potential voters and some guy pulls a knife on you and starts ranting and swearing and screaming about Donald Trump. We've already been through this at the congressional baseball game. Representative Steve Scalise remembers very well what it was like to be on the receiving end of the rage of a leftist. And we watched how the national media took that Hodgkinson attempted mass murder and just immediately moved on to other stories, because that's what they do. They don't want to talk about what their own side of the aisle is engaged in. And I want to go to the next cut, because this, I think, in some regard, speaks to the mentality of every mother who doesn't want her son to be exposed as the person he really is. This is just weird. This is cut two.
Fazeli's mother, Dolly Adams, says her son had been enjoying the day with the family. She was at the Democratic booth and remembers her son returning to the booth with cuts on his arm and blood on his shirt.
He came back to the booth. He told me the statement. Some man just from the Republican booth just shoved me on the ground. He told me he was afraid that the man would come at him again. And so, you know, he was trying to defend himself.
Adams said she told her son to go home, and that's when he was arrested. Deputies say they found the knife on him.
I wish I now had just kept him there at the booth and called the police right away and filed charges against Mr. Peters for assaulting my son.
Are you kidding me? It was the congressman's fault. Your son allegedly came up, was making obscene gestures, screaming obscenities about Donald Trump, and got into a scuffle and was going after this congressman, or this congressional candidate, I should say. And the congressman is trying to defend himself, holding up a sign, trying to block any sort of, you know, hurtful action against himself. And the congressional candidate is the one who ought to be arrested. Okay, this is why you never should really interview the mother. If the perpetrator is a far leftist and mom's on board, not good, because mom is blind. Mom is blind, and maybe he turned out that way because mom didn't really see reality for what it was for a very long time. At any rate, I want to let you listen to this. This is Congressman Steve Scalise, who actually was talking on Fox about how we are still divided. You know, on 9/11, we talked about the division that continues to plague the United States post 9/11. And you have the left way over on the same page with the Islamists. And then you have people on the right who are saying our country's under attack. And it was on 9/11 in a very overt way. But we continue to have great, great problems in the United States. We have sleeper cells, and we have ISIS sympathizers, and we have, you know, sleeper cells, Hezbollah. We have threats from Iran. I mean, we're always going to be under threat. And Christopher Wray, the FBI director, pointed out that we have terrorist threats from coast to coast in every sort of city, not just big ones, but also small towns. We know that. So why is it that we're still divided? This is what Scalise said. This is cut three.
Yeah, I get angry when I see that, because there's no place for that in American politics. You know, we've got this great country that our founders created where we can disagree with our government, with each other. But you've got to do it in a civil way. And we resolve our differences at the ballot box. That's what separates us from most other countries.
What responsibility do Democratic leaders have? Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and others. You see Maxine Waters continue to say, I'm going to threaten Trump officials. I want to not just impeach him, but I want to go after Trump officials. What responsibility do Democrats leaders have?
They need to be denouncing that kind of activity. There's no place for it. If somebody on the right was doing it, we'd be vocally denouncing it. They need to be denouncing that on the left. You should not incite violence or any kind of assaulting people based on their political views, and especially if it's somebody that's working in the administration and you're attacking them because of what they do and what they believe in. That's not what American ideals are about.
But increasingly, when we don't see the top echelon of the Democratic Party really denouncing this violence, speaking out against it, reaching out to Republican congressmen and Republican senators and saying, let's have a national town hall on no place for violence in American politics. We are totally in agreement with this. We might not be on the same page with every solution to every problem America has, but we're on agreement with this. I don't see this coming out of somebody like Cory Booker or Nancy Pelosi or so many on the left, Maxine Waters. Why aren't these people calling for a national town hall to absolutely condemn violence? I think because we are being a little bit blind to the history of the left. And I think that's part of our problem. We keep wanting people to be reasonable on the left, despite everything that we've seen happen in the last couple of years. We need to wake up. And when we come back, I'm going to get into more on why that is. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Stay with us.
Universal 1440 comes Unbroken, Path to Redemption. Based on the best-selling book telling the rest of the true story of Olympian and World War II hero Louis Zamperini.
Tonight, there's a drowning man just looking for some type of hope for the future. But there's a lifeline. Just reach out.
Unbroken, Path to Redemption. Rated PG-13. May be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters September 14th. More information is available at unbrokenfilm.com.
Janet Mefford Today is proud to partner with Preborn to help save babies' lives.
Well, my name is Dan Steiner, and I'm the president of Preborn. Ultrasound truly is a game changer. When a mom comes into a pregnancy center under pressure to abort her child, perhaps the dad's gone, perhaps her mother is pressuring her. Most of the time in her heart, she doesn't want to abort, but what she needs is something that will give her the strength to choose life against the pressures that are forcing her to consider abortion. That's the ultrasound. If she hears her baby's heartbeat and sees that baby on ultrasound, everything's different. 80% of the time, she'll choose life.
Will you join us in saving babies' lives? A $140 sponsorship gives five babies a chance at life, and you'll get a picture of the babies' lives that were saved. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, call now 855-601-BABY or 855-601-2229 or click the Preborn banner at janetmefford.com.
Whenever you find turmoil in families, whenever you find wars dominating family life, whenever you find tension and strife in a home continuously, you can be absolutely sure somehow the Word of God is not dominating the family.
Make plans to join Dr. Michael Youssef this week on Leading the Way.
Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Why is it we don't see more on the left, the top echelon of the left in the Democrat Party and elsewhere, standing up and condemning the violence of Antifa? This recent example in California of this man who is now under arrest and accused of attacking and trying to stab a Republican congressional candidate. We also have just so many other stories. There was D.C. McAllister, who's a conservative writer who posted a very strong pro-life message on Twitter last week and now has stepped away because she's had legitimate death and rape threats, including threats aimed at her family. I mean, this is what she tweeted. She said, at the root of abortion hysteria is women's unhinged desire for irresponsible sex. Sex is their God. Abortion is their sacrament. It's abhorrent as women have flung themselves from the heights of being the world's civilizing force to the muck and mire of dehumanizing depravity. Well said. I spiked the football on that one. That was a perfect tweet. It was great. And it was absolutely true. And what happens? She gets death and rape threats. She gets it through private communication and public communication. There are threats, she said, outside of Twitter, stating that they know where I live, threats of rape and strangling. I spoke to the police. I am on home watch. My children are very frightened. Pray for this woman. There's no reason she should be having to endure this. But what else is going on? Well, we had that Twitter account that had a threat to the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., an anonymous threat put out by an anonymous Twitter account supporting the Democratic Socialists. And it said, I am coming with a gun, and I expect to get numerous bloodstained MAGA hats as trophies. Make America great again, referencing Trump. This stuff is serious, guys. And I just don't know how many people understand this is growing. It's not going away. It's getting worse. And we ought to be paying a lot closer attention to the signs that are right there in front of us. It is not the case that you have huge voices on the left coming together in unison and decrying this with strong voices and putting a stop to it. Because I guarantee you, if they did that, they could put a stop to it. They could largely put a stop to it. They have contacts to all the top leftists and all the top organizations and think tanks throughout America. They could issue a top-down order. Everybody, knock it off. Just get Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton to issue word one. We're not going to do violence anymore. Knock it off. And it would stop tomorrow. It would. If that were to be issued, I firmly believe that's what would occur. The key is to understand groups like Antifa, people like this guy in California who was all about trying to stab a congressional candidate in the Republican Party. This was a little cut from a year ago. This was a journalist by the name of Tim Pool. He was at one of the Antifa rallies in Boston, and there was a very disturbing video of one of the Antifa members, complete with that headscarf across his mouth, screaming at him, threatening him, getting in his face, and being very, very scary. And he was asked on Fox, who are these people and what do they believe? And I think he nailed it. This is cut four.
It tends to be a mix of people. Predominantly, I found that they're communists. There's a lot of socialists involved and some anarchists. But typically, I think when you see the violence, the people who are willing to be more violent tend to be communists. That's more of a, I guess, structured ideology, whereas the anarchists are kind of a little loose and don't believe in the authority. But that video is not even the worst. You know, that's just one of the most recent. This guy didn't even touch me. But I've been physically attacked by people associated with the far left and Antifa in the past. And this is, like I said, just one of the more recent instances where they've confronted me for seemingly no reason. I mean, this guy doesn't know me. He doesn't know what I'm doing. I was just walking by in Boston with a camera, and immediately I got bombarded by a group of people with masks on just yelling at me.
All right. I think he's right on the money. And the reason I think he's right on the money is because if you study the history of the left and how it has used political violence in America, it goes back an awfully long way. There's one piece, for example, at Breitbart about this, saying that at the turn of the 1900s, when American leftism adopted a more Marxist, class-conscious bent found in the socialist, communist, and anarchist movements that often overlapped, political violence kicked into high gear in the United States, as it had in Europe. While the old continent succumbed to those leftist trends and incorporated them into its politics, the U.S. never quite did. But that didn't stop extremist groups from perpetrating a long list of acts of political violence, which continued from the 1900s era anarchists all the way to the Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter movements today. And beyond that, now today, you have Antifa. It began over 100 years ago, as the United States became afflicted with extremist actions perpetrated by these people. 1906, for example, to 1911. Starting in 1906, the violent left-wing labor movement in the U.S. began a campaign of terror bombings targeting American politicians and businessmen intended to force capitulation to union demands. In 1910, there was a bombing of the L.A. Times headquarters. As part of that union terror campaign, it was practically destroyed when John and James McNamara, both active in the International Association of Bridge and Structural Iron Workers, set off a bundle of dynamite at the building. And it killed 21 people, injured another 100 people. And the brothers, you know, had their innocence as an article of faith on the left until they admitted their guilt in detail. You had an anarchist bombing campaign in 1919. And there was also, as they say, much intrigue and murder inside the American communist scene itself as American members of the U.S. Communist Party became disillusioned with communism in Europe, especially that in the USSR. Two lamented communists are notable here. One was, born in 1886, Juliet Poyntz, an early activist in the American Socialist Movement. After first becoming active in the labor movement, Poyntz became fascinated by the Russian Revolution, siding with the communists. By the 20s, she had joined the Communist Party of the U.S. and became instrumental in the Friends of the Soviet Union. In 1937, she left her hotel room to meet a communist friend in Central Park, but after entering the park, she was abducted and disappeared without a trace. No hard facts are known of her demise, but it has been theorized she was eliminated by the Soviet state political directorate and either shipped off to a gulag or murdered here in the U.S. Then you go to the political assassinations. You had an anarchist assassinating William McKinley, our president, in 1901. The Idaho governor, Frank Sternberg, was killed in 1905 by members of a mining union, and a whole long list of leftists. You have the Black Panther Party. You have the Weather Underground. And by the way, can we talk about the Weather Underground? Because back during the Obama years, it was, oh, Bill Ayers, you know, he's just a guy who lived in my neighborhood. And he wasn't. That was a complete lie. And it was just, well, move on. Who cares? Weather Underground. Well, the communist-inspired Weather Underground aimed to foment revolution. and was not averse to perpetrating bombings to achieve it. It was an offshoot of the Socialist College Group, Students for a Democratic Society. The Weather Underground perpetrated several acts of terror. In 1970, San Francisco policeman Brian McDonald died in an unsolved bombing that many suspect involved weathermen. Three of their own members also lost their lives when a bomb prematurely detonated in a Greenwich Village townhouse in 1970. And they keep going. And Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, remember him? And what about environmental and animal rights terrorism? And on and on and on. There is a history of leftist violence. And we cannot discount the fact that communism has a whole lot to do with it. Nobody wants to talk about communism because it's become such a punchline. You know, what are you, a communist? You know, it's really been this stuff of laughter over the last 20 years, post-Cold War. Ah, the communists, they're not a threat anymore. Sure, during the Cold War, we understood the evil empire and what they were doing was holding people, you know, really hostage when you think about East Germany. And when that wall came down, it was absolutely unbelievable. Nobody ever thought they would live to see the day where the Berlin Wall fell, but it did. And people were dancing and drinking and hugging and crying and were all excited. And, you know, bit by bit, the domino effect was that communism, as it seemed at the time, was gone for good, at least in that part of the world. Sure, we still had China, we still had Cuba, we still had North Korea, but in that part of the world where it had been so pervasive and so many millions of people had been its victims, it seemed like it was over. Well, it was never really over. And what people don't tend to understand is that bad ideology that leads to millions of people being killed can always revive when a new generation of people want to use it for their own agendas. And unfortunately, folks, we do have to face the fact that you have a lot of people who are embracing, if not full-blown communism publicly, although some are, you have more and more legitimate, quote-unquote, candidates who are running as Democrats who are socialists. And don't tell me that it's all of the European variety and we'll stay of the European variety. That is, we want to have some form of socialist control of certain services like healthcare. We can talk all day about what a disaster that is. Just look at Obamacare. Just look at the National Health Service in the UK. We can talk about that. But really what we ought to fear is these people who are becoming more and more violent and how we don't have those left leaders, those left-leaning leaders who are leading the charge. Of course, I expect Republican congressmen and senators to denounce violence, but when you don't see it coming from the top echelons of the Democrat Party, I think you should be concerned. I think I need to be concerned because difficult times are upon us. People who are irreconcilable in some situations and certainly haters of good and some of them brutal. We are living through a difficult time like this. It's why we need to pray for our country, but it's also why we need to work to uphold the values and the freedoms that we enjoy as Americans. If we don't fight for our republic, we will lose it. And now's the time to stand up and by the grace of God, make sure that we don't end up like those countries that have fallen to socialism. We can't do it. Hey, thanks a lot for being with us here on Janet Mefford Today. We'll see you next time.